Je te laisserai des mots. Written by RJSLV and read by Wilfriede0815. Fandoms, Hated Rivalry, Game Changer Series, This Is How You Lose the Time War. Relationship, Shane Hollander / Ilya Rosanoff. Rating, Explicit. No archive warnings apply. Additional tags, Alternate Universe, Fusion, Science Fiction, Time Travel, Secret Relationship. Summary. It's Hollander's work. Ilya knows it with one glance. The structure is too orderly, laid out neatly according to plan. There are redundancy loops and opposing threads twisted together for stability. It's precise, complex, beautiful to witness. It will be a fucking nightmare for Ilya to pick apart. This is why the time war has lasted so long, why it feels unending. Every action Ilya takes will be countered by a voyageur. Every one of their moves will be undone in turn. Or, this is how you lose the Ice War. Chapter 1. Countdown to a Hot Mess. Most people would probably say the worst thing about an ice age is the cold. It is cold. It's fucking freezing. Keeping it that way is the entire reason Ilya is here. He spent days releasing sulfur dioxide aerosols above the troposphere and thickening the sea ice. He sprayed seawater into the thick stratocumulus clouds that blanket the sea, so much that the air tastes salty when he sucks his lower lip absently between his teeth. His efforts have already paid off. The strand will be minus 0.2 degrees Celsius cooler than any other timeline within the next 1,000 years, throwing off the glacial-interglacial cycle normally balanced by the Earth's obliquity. Ilya's actions will change the course of the entire planet. His breath clouds the air when he exhales. The temperature is still above freezing point at the height of each day, but not by much. Ilya has been bundled up inside his waterproof thermal suit since he arrived. The bitter cold isn't what gets to him, though. It's the isolation. The pristine, desolate landscape that stretches unbroken for kilometers in every direction. That's enough to drive a person mad. Something flickers in his vision. Ilya scans the horizon until he catches it again. A flash of reflective silver, out of place against a snowy prehistoric backdrop. He checks his conducted energy weapon first, confirming that it holds a full electroshock charge. Whatever's out there is too far away to reach him anytime soon, but he isn't taking any chances with the megafauna that roam these ice sheets. Even the beavers have teeth nearly as big as his dick. Ilya's optic lenses are polarized to filter high-frequency visible light and ultraviolet radiation. He'd have been snowblind days ago otherwise. He switches to an infrared filter and checks again, adjusting the magnification to see what's out there. There's someone out on the ice, bipedal and roughly Ilya's size, wearing a padded parka trimmed with actual organic mammal fur. It could be a hallucination, but Ilya doesn't think so. If his mind were playing tricks, it's more likely to conjure a giant dancing bear. The hominins in the strand wouldn't have high-visibility reflective patches sewn onto their sleeves or synthetic traction studs on their boots. At least not until many centuries from now. Which means, this must be another agent. Ilya's caught glimpses of a hunter dogging his missions across a few strands before now, but this isn't the same man. It's not anyone from Ilya's side. He'd recognize the tech. And he'd remember that face. The voyageurs take after the boatman for which they're named, crawling up thread and down like they're ferrying goods along a river. Direct encounters with enemy agents are rare, but with so many foot soldiers deployed across threads of time, sometimes conflict is inevitable. Whatever this agent is doing here, it can't be good for Ilya or his mission. Cursing, he activates the satellite link to a constellation of mirrors high overhead. He launched them into space a few days ago to reduce the amount of solar energy that enters the atmosphere. The receivers blink red on his wristband. Signal lost. He doesn't need to squint through the fat white clouds to confirm the mirrors have been knocked out of the sky. The voyageur across the ice is investigating one of Ilya's largest cultivated glaciers. They're separated by distance and a wide expanse of ice-crusted sea. He doesn't appear hostile, which honestly comes as a surprise to Ilya. He expected to need his energy weapon after all. The other agent seems to be taking measurements, precise calculations that involve tribrachs and theodolites. Every so often he pauses to study Ilya, before moving on to the next point on his invisible map. There's a moment of mutual uncertainty after the voyageur finishes his calculations and packs away his gear. He faces Ilya across the ice, hands held awkwardly at his sides like he's not sure what comes next. He waves. Ilya curses again, not that he thinks the voyageur can hear him at this distance. He hikes his pack higher up onto his shoulder, and is weighing whether or not to risk a close engagement, when the other agent turns and walks away. He must have done whatever he'd been sent here to do. Unravel Ilya's work in deflecting solar radiation, almost certainly. The voyageur must intend to make the planet more habitable in the relatively near future. This is why the war has lasted so long, why it feels unending. Every action Ilya takes will be countered by a voyageur. Every one of their moves, in turn, will be undone by someone on his side. The snow muffles everything, turns the world silent and oppressive. The crack of breaking ice cuts through that quiet like a sharp knife. The sound grows louder, cracks layering over one another until they're eclipsed by the low groan of an unstable terminus. Ilya knows that sound in his bones. It's a warning to get off the fucking ice. There's a distant thundering boom, and then a massive chunk of ice begins to tilt and break away. More pieces shear off and fall, setting off violent waves as they crash into the water below. Ilya stands impotent on his side of the ice, watching his beautiful, load-bearing glacier calve into the frigid sea. He could go up there to try again, but he doesn't see the point. The voyageurs know he's here and what he's trying to do. There's nothing stopping the other agent from following him to another point in the timeline. They'll waste their energy trading brief victories instead of pursuing a real advantage. Ilya's wristband blinks. The satellite link has been re-established. One of his space reflectors is broadcasting a signal. The voyageur has left a message. By the time you read this, I'll have reported back to management and they'll be monitoring the strand. I wouldn't stick around if I were you. Your solar geoengineering is really impressive. I've never seen surface albedo increase through technology like this before. You shouldn't mess around with planetary temperature, but in another 14,000 years, carbon emissions and global warming will be a real problem. This is good work. Good luck out there. I hope you end up somewhere warmer next time. Shane breathes in the grimy air of Strand 1410 and tastes ash. He imagines it lining his windpipe, settling in his lungs like sediment at the bottom of a river. The chromatophores under his skin keep trying to shift, reorienting plates and translocating pigments, confused into metachrosis. He walks through pre-amalgamation Toronto like it's his own personal Stabiae. The burnt-out skeletons of blackened buildings stretch out on either side of Shane as he approaches the intersection. The poor visibility isn't the only reason his nerves are twitching. There's every chance he's walking into an ambush. Most of what Shane knows about this mission is inference and rumor. The raiders had made the initial overture, a one-time exchange of information pertaining to select agents who'd been confirmed lost in the war. After some negotiation, the voyageur had agreed. The raiders have sent Rosanoff to make the exchange. That part isn't a surprise. Rosanoff has thwarted several of Shane's recent missions, untangling threads Shane had carefully braided and throwing the voyageur's plans into chaos. He exemplifies the raiders' combat style, popping up with no warning to launch a sudden and devastating attack before vanishing without a trace. Shane would have been more annoyed if he hadn't known he was just as much of a problem for the raiders. Instead of frustrating him, Rosanoff drives him to work harder, to think faster. He wonders if the raiders have noticed, if that's why they requested Shane specifically to make this exchange. Rosanoff waits for him at the intersection, slouched against the crumbling brick wall scorched black by the fire. He straightens up when Shane arrives, hands in his pockets. The casual, bored attitude might be intended as an insult, but Shane's tight shoulders relax by a few degrees. Rosanoff wouldn't be peacocking like this in plain sight if the plan was to snipe Shane from a broken window and steal the data drive. Shane stops a few meters away, just close enough that he doesn't have to raise his voice. "Did you bring it?" "Bring what?" Rozanov makes a show of checking his coat pockets and flipping back the edge of his wool cloak. He rolls his eyes when Shane opens his mouth again. Of course I brought it. He holds out a brown, leather-bound journal. When Shane hesitates, Rozanov gives it an impatient little shake. Shane walks the rest of the way over to take the book out of his hand. He unwraps the leather thong that binds the journal closed, cracking open the cover just enough to confirm the presence of a storage drive hidden inside. It's more trust than Shane would have shown. Another voyageur might have tried their luck by cutting and running. Now that he has the drive, however, he fulfills his own side of the bargain without hesitation. The microchip is glossy black and small enough to nearly disappear when Shane tips it onto Rozanov's glove. Rozanov stares down at it, his brow pinched, then looks back up at Shane.
What the fuck is this?
Shane opens his mouth, then closes it again. He's not sure he understands the question.
A subdermal implant? The database should interface with any major operating system. The corrupted files have been quarantined, but they were included with the recovered files, just in case your side could do anything with them. It's all on there, he finishes lamely.
He sounds more defensive than he ought to, but Rozanov is staring at him like he's a two-headed fish. Rozanov mutters something that Shane can't understand. It sounds like Russian. Shane wonders if they're having translation issues.
Chip?
He tries again, gesturing with his thumb and forefinger close together. He taps the base of his skull, the most common location for an accessible terminal. When Rozanov's expression doesn't change, Shane blurts out without thinking,
Do you not know how to read it?
Why would I know how to read this?
Rozanov sounds incredulous. Shane doesn't know how to answer. The idea of not having embedded microchips is such a foreign one that he's still wrapping his head around it. Rozanov gives up on waiting for him and thrusts the microchip back toward Shane.
You read it.
What?
Shane holds up his hands reflexively in a warning gesture. No, it's yours. Rozanov waves the chip in an impatient little circle.
You tell me what it says. I will record.
It's classified.
Panic starts to rise in Shane's throat. This is a critical mission, with potentially devastating consequences if it fails, and it's already going sideways.
I'm not supposed to see what's on there.
But you can access the data, yes?
Rozanov gestures again, annoyed now. Chop chop.
You know how?
Yeah, of course, but...
Shane bites off the rest of his protest. Management might tear him apart for stealing military secrets, but he doesn't see an alternative. Rozanov clearly isn't going anywhere until he's gotten what he was sent here for. In his place, Shane wouldn't either.
Fine. I should be able to project it. Do you have a visual recorder?
Obviously,
Rozanov says. Like Shane's the idiot for asking when Rozanov is the one who can't read microchips. The terminal on the inside of Shane's wrist is the most convenient. He pulls off his gloves and slides his thumbnail under the loose flap of skin at the base of his palm. He's acutely aware of Rozanov watching as he slots the microchip into the exposed terminal. He takes a deep breath before accessing the database and immediately regrets it.
What is it? Rozanov asks sharply.
He must have seen Shane's face twist as he tried not to cough, and misinterpreted it as a reaction to the data. Shane shakes his head.
Nothing, it's fine. I don't like the smoke.
Rozanov raises an eyebrow.
You shouldn't have set the city on fire.
I didn't.
Shane cuts himself off and raises his wrist. Are you ready to record? Rozanov smirks at him. He has a generous mouth, a square jaw, sharp cheekbones. Shane feels the back of his neck flush, prickles of heat crawling under his skin. His chromatophores must be acting up again.
Go ahead, Rozanov tells him. Put on a show for me.
Jane, see how clever I am using code names. You were so worried about doing something wrong, not being the perfect agent. Now, if anyone else reads this, no one will know it's meant for you. The information exchange was my idea. I wanted to see you again, to see more of you than the trails you leave behind you in time. Would you have come
if you'd known it was for me. I think if you didn't want to be alone with me, you wouldn't have been here. I think you were curious. See you around, Lily.
Chapter 2. Talking Trash Under My Window. Breaking into a cutting-edge supercomputer is surprisingly easy. It helps that Ilya has access to technology from Strand 1221's near future. It's advanced enough to circumvent the current security, but similar enough to be compatible with the facility's systems. I can't shake the feeling that it should be more of a challenge. The surveillance cameras have suspiciously helpful blind spots. Several alarms are already offline when Ilya goes to disable them. The map overlaid on his optic lens prompts him to turn left, down one of the long rows of processor cores. They're indistinguishable, as far as he can tell. He doesn't know how anyone navigates this place to do maintenance. He turns twice more, delving deeper into the labyrinth, until he reaches the unit highlighted on his map. It looks exactly like the others, stacked blades of servers, with a cluster of thick cables secured along the sides. Ilya hasn't become the best agent among the raiders by ignoring his gut. He has sharp reaction times and an uncanny intuition for what his opponents will do next. Right now, those instincts are telling him that something about this doesn't feel right. Ilya switches on his infrared filter. His target processor shows up as a colorless gap, no longer generating heat. It's dead or disabled, quarantined from the rest of the supercomputer and unable to carry the virus that Ilya had been sent here to plant. He bangs his fist against the metal frame and exhales hard. Hollander has outmaneuvered him again. It's the latest example in a string of humiliations. Objectively, Ilya knows that they're evenly matched, and that he's been ahead of Hollander as often as he's fallen behind. He also knows that the Colonel won't see it that way. The only metrics Ilya is judged by are his failures. He pushes himself off the frame and turns partly away before pausing. One corner of the server blade is marred. Black paint has been scratched off to reveal the silver metal beneath. Ilya looks closer and sees similar marks on the screws holding the front panel in place. He's curious, and his mission is already fucked. Ilya takes apart the unit. He revises his opinion of the situation once his hands are in the guts of the machine. This isn't Hollander's work. The raiders have the edge when it comes to computer power. They've built, upgraded, and stolen enough to fuel a new digital age, and they're scrappy enough to stay on the cutting edge. Where the Voyageurs have an advantage is biotechnology. They tend to integrate rather than equip, melding genetics and computing into one flawless design. Whoever took out Ilya's target before him, they did it by hand, with metal tools, and they'd left evidence behind. The plastic casing around one of the cables has been scored imprecisely by a knife, and one of the copper strands of wire has been twisted back on itself where it frayed loose. There's a screw missing in one of the metal plates. Hollander would never be so untidy. Footsteps echo off the bare walls. Ilya swears and fumbles components back into place, jamming the front panel onto the processor just as Hollander rounds the corner at the end of the aisle. Hollander freezes when he sees Ilya. His eyes dart from Ilya to the unit, obviously taken off guard, and Ilya's hunch hardens into certainty. Hollander turns to bolt back the way he'd come, and Ilya calls out before he can disappear. Wait! Hollander looks back over his shoulder and hesitates. Ilya holds up both hands, showing himself to be unarmed. That isn't completely true, but the sentiment is honest. He has no intention of harming Hollander. Ilya tips his head toward the server blade, then takes a step back to give Hollander room. He lets curiosity do the rest. Hollander stays put for a handful of seconds, then moves cautiously toward Ilya. He stops in front of the unit to peer at the subject of Ilya's little investigation, and his shoulders stiffen in realization. Ilya waits patiently while Hollander carries out his own inspection. They're standing close enough for him to imagine he can feel the heat of Hollander's body next to him in the chilled room. The fabric of Hollander's anti-static fiber jumpsuit is black enough to swallow even the harsh fluorescent light, and soft enough to cling to every curve of muscle.
Hollander glances sideways at him, and Ilya drags his eyes reluctantly up from the swell of Hollander's ass. It's a nice ass. Ilya has noticed this several times before. This isn't your work, Hollander says, without a shred of uncertainty. Ilya feels a stupid little thrill that his closest competition knows Ilya's style as well as Ilya knows his.
No, not yours either.
Obviously, Hollander says. Anyone else might have leaned into the contempt of that word, made it a snide condescension. Hollander's statement is a simple statement of fact.
Not any of the voyageurs,
Hollander continues, confirming Ilya's suspicion. He darts another glance at Ilya. None of the raiders either? Ilya shakes his head. Hollander looks back at the processor, brow furrowed. Then he does exactly what Ilya had, replacing everything as it had been, tidying away the evidence of sabotage.
We shouldn't talk here, Hollander says.
Ilya taps the thick blue and red hoses on the back of the unit behind them.
Liquid cooling center. Plenty of waterfall noise. It will drown out surveillance.
Hollander mutters something that sounds like, you hope. He searches Ilya's face for a moment before suggesting cautiously,
you know who did this?
Ilya shrugs. I have suspicions. Hollander's gaze drops to Ilya's lower lip, sucked in between his teeth. Ilya is suddenly far less interested in that saboteur than he is in the way Hollander's eyes linger on the wet gleam of Ilya's mouth. He takes a step forward. It's the wrong move. Hollander snaps out of his distraction and shifts away, putting distance between them. He hesitates one last time, then raises his arm and presses his thumb against the metal frame of the processing core. Before Ilya can call after him a second time, he's turned out of sight, disappearing into the maze. Ilya doesn't try to chase him. He studies the frame instead, with the faintest sheen of oil left behind from Hollander's touch. He scans the whorls of Hollander's thumbprint, and the lines rearrange themselves into a new pattern.
Lily, it's too dangerous for us to have this conversation on a mission. Both sides will monitor any way they consider critical. You know they'll be watching and listening. You have my biometric code now, so you can read my encrypted messages. I'll find somewhere else for us to talk freely. Or I'll find you.
Jane. Strand 1822 is nearly uninhabitable. The landscape on the surface is scarred by acid rain, atmospheric pollution so thick that it's impossible for humans to breathe the air. The world has been relinquished to cockroaches and tardigrades. It's one of the first major casualties of the Time War. The site of so many skirmishes and operations that it's considered past saving, forfeits by both sides in favor of more viable battlegrounds. That makes it one of the few places the voyageurs and the raiders are both likely to avoid. Shane makes his way through the subterranean tunnels that crisscross the island. The network extends for more than 30 kilometers, and while the radiation and decay aren't limited to the surface, conditions are far better underground. He unseals the pressurized hatch that leads into the biosphere. There are a few structures left standing in this world, like this one, closed ecological systems that survive the ravages of the war outside. Lush, vibrant gardens, teeming with life, as fragile as a soap bubble. The water comes as a shock. Shane stows completely in seconds, the downpour hitting him hard enough to stagger him. He lunges forward by instinct, trying to escape the thick curtain of water obscuring his vision. Rozanov's voice cuts through his alarm.
It's okay. Decontamination shower. Come this way.
Shane follows the sound and finds himself wading through a shallow pool, the artificial waterfall behind him still pouring over the entrance to the tunnels. He wipes his face with both hands, feeling like a drowned rat, before looking up to see Rozanov standing a few meters ahead of him. Rozanov clearly hadn't fared any better against the unexpected shower. His hair is slicked back from his angular face and dripping onto his shoulders. A black and yellow hazmat suit is peeled down to his waist, displaying wet, gleaming chest muscles. Shane's entire body goes hot so fast that it feels like a radiation burn. By some miracle, Rozanov doesn't seem to notice. He's too busy gaping at Shane in turn. What is this? Are you part fish too?
Shane looks down at his exposed hands and wrists. Now that he's paying attention, he can feel the plates that have shifted on the surface of his skin, the faint pattern of leptoid scales that must show along his neck where the water has pulled his clothes askew.
Oh, no, it's, only when I'm submerged. I can mostly control them. I was just surprised.
Therefore, hydrodynamics? He doesn't know why he makes that into a question, as though he doesn't know his own body anymore.
Rosanoff mouths the word back at him, still marveling. His gaze drifts all the way down to Shane's thighs, just above the water level, before traveling back up to his face.
Shane is beginning to wonder if he really did get a hit of thermal radiation somehow.
He clears his throat.
You were going to tell me what happened in Nashville.
Rosanoff smirks at him, holding eye contact.
I don't think that's what you came here for.
He raises his eyebrows and looks pointedly down, so Shane does the same. He realizes first that he's hard, and second that with his clothes plastered to his skin, there's no way to disguise that fact as anything else.
Rosanoff waits slowly toward him. Shane doesn't notice himself moving away to maintain a safe distance until his back hits the smooth, wet stone beside the waterfall. He lifts his chin when Rosanoff cages him in against the rocks. It should be defiant. Except that Shane can't stop staring at Rosanoff's lips.
We're safe here, Rosanoff tells him.
Shane doesn't think they're safe anywhere, but he doesn't want to argue. There are too many other desires clamoring under his skin.
Rosanoff kisses open mouth and slow, like he wants to devour Shane and take his time savoring. Shane is too hungry for that. He's ravenous. Rosanoff pulls back between kisses, and Shane chases after him, unwilling to break contact. He slides his tongue into Rosanoff's mouth and fists his hands into the bunched fabric at Rosanoff's waist. Rosanoff's hands are in his hair, on his chest, at his throat. Shane's last trace of caution evaporates in their wake. They strip each other bare, still kissing, only pausing to stare at the display of muscles flexing under newly exposed skin. Rosanoff maneuvers them away from the wall, guiding them with his hands on Shane's hips. When Shane misses a step on the slippery bottom of the pool, Rosanoff wraps strong hands around Shane's thighs and lifts him up out of the water. He lays Shane out on the mossy bank and crawls on top of him, water streaming off him to drip onto Shane's goose-pimpled skin. Rosanoff's hand curls around his jaw, holding him in place for another kiss. When he pulls back, there's something stuck to Shane's skin, right at his pulse point. There's also a thin wire leading from it back to Rosanoff's fingertip. Shane freezes. Rosanoff must feel him lock up, because he breaks off from going in for another kiss and pulls back to look at Shane's face. Shane is thinking about the Raiders' conducted energy devices and electroshock weapons. How he's soaking wet and defenseless. How little it will take to stop his heart. Rosanoff holds up his hands. It's the same gesture he made in Nashville, the one that promises he means no harm. It's somewhat undermined by the pads Shane can see on each of his fingertips, sticky white rings around a bright metal center.
Are those fucking electrodes?
Shane scrabbles at his neck to tear the adhesive away. Rosanoff makes a little distressed noise, although Shane can't tell whether it's in response to Shane foiling his plan or the panic quickening Shane's breath. Rosanoff reaches for Shane's throat again, and Shane nearly jabs an elbow into his windpipe before he realizes Rosanoff is trying to help him. Rosanoff gets the adhesive detached and untangles the razor-thin wire from Shane's fingers, cradling them carefully as he checks for damage. They stare at each other for a long moment, unmoving. Then Rosanoff says cautiously,
"This isn't how you do it, in the Voyageurs."
Shane's heart rate hasn't come down, still pounding in his chest.
How we do what, exactly? Sex?
Rosanoff nods.
Calibration.
Finding the right words in English looks like a struggle. He presses one of the electrodes against his own chest in demonstration. Shane watches the muscle jump.
Small shock. To find the best spots.
Erogenous zones. Shane relaxes slowly onto the moss, amusement seeping in to replace his shock.
No, we don't do that. I could just tell you.
Rosanoff smirks down at him, all swagger and confidence again. He leans down and murmurs into Shane's ear.
And where would you think to tell me about, besides your dick?
Shane's having trouble thinking about anything that isn't his dick. Rosanoff must see the answer on his face, because he chuckles and kisses Shane's ear. Shane shivers, although that might come from the cold water still dripping off Rosanoff's wet curls.
Tell me if you don't like it, and we stop.
Rosanoff kisses down Shane's neck, distracting him from the light brush of Rosanoff's fingers. When he finally pulls back, wires trail from his fingers to the adhesive pad stuck all over Shane's body, like he's some kind of sexy puppet master.
Tell me, he says again, ducking down for another kiss.
And then Shane's nerve endings light up as Rosanoff starts fucking calibrating him.
Fuck!
Shane's spine bows off the ground, pinprick shocks dancing across his skin. Rosanoff slides an arm under his back, supporting him while his muscles jump and he curses in two different languages. It doesn't hurt, exactly. It's more like a buzz under his skin, a tingle that travels from his nerve endings through his entire body. He doesn't know how this is supposed to tell Rosanoff anything about erogenous zones, because every single tap and twitch feels like it's directly wired to his dick. Rosanoff is still kissing him, even with Shane panting, mouth open and slack. His hand roams over Shane's face, fingers threading through his hair. There's a single electrode still stuck to the pad of his thumb. Shane turns his head and sucks Rosanoff's thumb between his lips. He feels the adhesive catch and stick. Hears Rosanoff groan,
"Fuck, Hollander!"
And then the sweet sting of a shock against his tongue. Rosanoff presses his thumb down on Shane's tongue and kisses Shane around it, licking into Shane's mouth. There's a polite beep, and the fire crackling through Shane's body gradually abates. He goes limp, breathing hard, already feeling halfway wrecked. Rosanoff peels the sticky little pads from Shane's skin and detaches the wires from his own fingertips, tossing them aside.
"Well," Rosanoff says after a moment, "that was fun."
Shane's mouth drops open again.
"Wait, that was it? Voyageurs do it differently?"
Rosanoff asks it with such smug, shit-eating innocence that Shane tackling him onto the ground feels like an out-of-body experience, fueled purely by outrage and horny indignation. He resurfaces from his lust-induced blackout with both hands on Rosanoff's chest, Rosanoff's hips gripped tight between his knees, and a thin trail of saliva snapping between his mouth and Rosanoff's lower lip.
"I don't know, I can't calibrate you," Shane says.
He doesn't wait for whatever smirking comeback Rosanoff is waiting on his tongue. His sensory receptors are in overdrive, converting every point of contact into electrical signals that drown out everything else. He wants to get his hands on Rosanoff, his mouth around him, the blissful weight and pressure of him everywhere against Shane's skin. Shane's body knows what it wants. He can figure out the rest as he goes.
"Jane, the agent you wanted to know about is called Hunter. I see him sometimes on missions. Never when I see you. I thought he might be a defector to your side. I tell you, because you're very annoying about this, even when I give you much better things to think about. I hid this message in fiber optic cable, so I could imagine your face when you see it. Did you get hard, remembering the calibration wires? I want to fuck you next time. I think, when I'm inside you, you would beg for me with your pretty mouth. I think you want that too. Until next time, Lily."
Chapter 3. All you think of lately is getting underneath me. The Raiders have set up headquarters on the Jemchujina, a massive container ship the size of a small city, floating above the rising waters of the Black Sea. Ilya crosses the suspension bridge that anchors the ship to the coast, through wisps of cloud that leave water vapor clinging to his skin. He shivers at the chill, the insubstantial, clammy touch that lingers on the back of his neck under his high collar. It reminds him of Hollander,
as everything seems to lately. Hollander soaked to the skin from a decontamination shower, hands cool and damp as Ilya set about warming him up. The way Hollander had shuddered as they explored each other, responsive to every touch. Hollander had met Ilya's desire with unrestrained hunger, like he'd been starving and Ilya was a feast. He'd been embarrassed about it afterward, charmingly squeamish about smeared lubricant and wires tangled all around him in the aftermath of sex. Ilya shouldn't be thinking of that now, Ether reports to the corrugated metal container that serves as the colonel's office. There's flirting with danger, and then there's outright suicide. Ilya needs to keep his head in the game. You failed. It's a dispassionate greeting. The colonel barely looks at him when Ilya slips inside the door. The tone declares the colonel disappointed, but not surprised. Ilya knows better than to reply. He stands to attention in front of the colonel's desk, waiting for orders. The colonel ignores him while he finishes keying something into a tablet. Then he stands and activates a holographic projection that fills the center of the room. Ilya has studied it for so long, he sees the shape of it in his dreams. It's a sand table, a battle map. It's all of time, charted across every known strand in existence. Your last mission should have secured this strand for the foreseeable future. Now we are going to lose it, and all of these threats besides. Not only my mission, Ilya can't help saying it, even knowing it won't make any difference. The colonel's eyes focus on him, cold and piercing. You are the vanguard. Our site's success depends on you. When you fail, you take the others down with you. Yes, sir. The colonel turns back to the sand table. His lip curls. I thought this one might give you trouble, but you didn't even make it that far. Ilya pulls his attention from the colonel with effort, following his gaze past the frayed threads that mark Ilya's disastrous last mission. Behind them, Ilya sees the tidy, closely plotted strands of a fishtail braid running backwards up the timeline. It's Hollander's work. Ilya knows it with one glance. The structure is too orderly, everything laid out according to plan. There are redundancy loops and opposing threads twisted together for stability. It's precise, complex, beautiful to witness. It will be a fucking nightmare for Ilya to pick apart. If this one is a problem for you, the colonel begins. He doesn't need to finish. Ilya knows his line. It is not a problem. It will be a challenge to counter the voyageur's efforts, but not impossible. If there's one thing Ilya knows how to unravel, it's Hollander. The colonel nods. You leave immediately. We'll prepare for a strategic withdrawal and establish a new command center elsewhere. Ilya tries to hide his surprise. You expect an invasion? The voyageurs know we are here now. They would be foolish not to interfere. The colonel smiles. It's a wolfish thing, sitting uncomfortably against the frown lines of his face. Besides, we're counting on it. Ilya searches his face for some hint of what he's thinking. You want the voyageur to take Sochi? It's not ideal, but it's inevitable. When they come, we'll be ready for them. The colonel returns to his desk. Ilya follows after him, interest piqued. He sees very little of the big picture, the military decisions made by men and women, but mostly men, with medals and powerful friends. The colonel produces a glass vial from a drawer and sets it on the desk. After a moment, Ilya holds it up to the light. There's a fragment of wood inside, half eaten by rot. Patches of green-black decay have spread over the surface of the wood, smudging the insides of the glass. Ilya looks back at the colonel. A biological weapon? Better than that. The colonel takes the vial back from Ilya and looks at it with pride, like a favored child. A distinctive contagion. The strand will be infested with the stuff. When the voyageurs arrive in force, their agents will pick it up, and we'll be able to track them wherever they go. Ilya's chest squeezes. This will give them an edge, one they can use to win the war. He shouldn't be thinking about Hollander's honest, trusting face, or the fact that his contagion will undoubtedly spread among the raiders as well. Both of them could carry invisible spores that might give them away and seal their doom.
Ilya keeps his voice bland.
It's dangerous. We can neutralize it if it becomes a problem for any of our people.
The colonel puts the vial back inside the desk. Ilya can't take his eyes from it until the drawer slides shut. When he looks up, the colonel is frowning at him.
When are you leaving for Regina?
Ilya goes still.
That mission was abandoned, he says carefully.
He remembers the isolation, the endless ice, the groan of a calving glacier. Hollander in the bright wintry sunlight, waving. The colonel pauses. For a moment, he looks confused. Then his expression goes blank again, and he sits behind his desk, resuming control.
You have another?
This isn't the first time Ilya has seen a continuity lapse. It happens rarely, as far as he knows. Moments of disorientation between strands and times. The colonel has spent his entire life fighting this war. It's not shocking that his mind sometimes loses track of the threads. It might be the first time, however, with a bioweapon stored in a glass vial and an entire strand's timeline hanging in the balance, that Ilya has felt a deep, unsettling disquiet after seeing it.
The fishtail braid, he answers. One of the 1600s.
Yes, the colonel agrees. Ilya can't tell if he's remembered or simply latched onto what Ilya said.
Try to do better.
Ilya crosses the sky bridge again when he leaves. It might be the last time he does. He wants to look down one more time, into the sparkling turquoise sea. In the citrus grove on the far side, he finds a message from Hollander. It's embedded in concentric tree rings, a single branch grafted onto a sturdy trunk. Ilya snaps it off and pockets it without reading. The smell of oranges stays with him for days.
Lily, are you okay?
You're probably getting tired of me asking that. I thought I'd hear from you by now. I hope you got my messages. I hope you're all right.
There are so many quotes about lilies, did you know? I looked some up, but I don't know, I'm not as poetic as you are. Maybe I'm just running out of things to say. I guess I'll see you around sometime.
Jane. Shane stands under the shade of an awning and watches a mushroom cloud bloom in the distance. The instruments running evaluations and simulation projections light up next to him with another stream of data. This trend is on course to self-destruct within the next century. Management would prefer the future be nudged in a slightly different direction. Strategic potential was the official verdict. The raiders haven't shown any interest in interfering, which is good news for Shane's mission. There's no reason for him to be disappointed. His instruments spit out a new set of numbers, a familiar warning since Shane arrived in the valley. Seismic activity, foreshock predictions, strain energy. The Frenchman Mountain Fault is being pushed to its limit by this timeline's accelerated nuclear testing. Unstable ground, the monitor reads. That feels familiar too. He hasn't heard from Rosanoff since the biosphere in Montreal. Not that he has any reason to. He just expected something. More than this cold shoulder silent treatment. A second warning flashes on the screen, but this one isn't about tectonic movement. Temporal displacement. Shane collapses his instruments into their carry case, rolls up the awning, and stows everything in his trailer. It's a drill he could probably run in his sleep. At the first sign of enemy engagement, Shane will take his gear and evacuate. He wonders briefly if it's Hunter. They haven't met directly, but Hunter had left a message for him up thread, so Shane knows he's been around. He doesn't let himself hope for anyone else. That's what he tells himself, anyway. Until he recognizes his visitor. Rosanoff wears pleated shorts and aviator shades, a cheerful scarf tied under the open collar of a salmon pink shirt. He should look ridiculous. Shane shouldn't see the sweat collecting at his throat and think about biting him.
Rosanoff slides the aviators down the end of his nose to look at Shane's travel trailer.
Wow, nice place.
Shut up, it's a Shasta. Shane is aware that it looks like a canned ham in an eye-watering shade of blue. But it's appropriate for the time and place. Vintage. Shane is blending in.
Rosanoff looks over his shoulder toward the dissipating mushroom cloud. The smoke is drifting their way on the wind. Shane is already grimacing at the thought of the radiation treatment he'll have to run afterward.
I see your side has resorted to blowing things up in the middle of nowhere.
Shane might have tried teasing back once, but that was 6 months of radio silence ago. I'm not giving you operational details.
Rosanoff walks forward, past polite distance and well into Shane's personal space. How he manages to loom over Shane when they're essentially the same heights is a mystery.
I think I could convince you.
Shane's mask of stoic indifference snaps like a rubber band.
Fuck you! I'm not giving you shit!
No. Rosanoff steps even closer. Shane refuses to back down, which leaves them standing nose to nose. He can smell fresh sweat and the sharp green apple scent of pomade.
This is not what you want.
Rosanoff leans in slowly, telegraphing the movement. His lips brush the shell of Shane's ear, then the hinge of his jaw, trailing down Shane's throat.
God help him, Shane doesn't move away.
Not in the open,
he grits out, when Rosanoff's hands land on his hips. The last thing he needs to deal with is this strand's version of a lavender scare. Rosanoff smirks at him when Shane wrenches the trailer door open and backs inside. It's a tight fit for one grown man, let alone two. Rosanoff is nearly on top of him just by climbing through the door.
It's like a nest, Rosanoff comments, settling over him. Bird's nest of tiny pillows.
Shut up,
Shane says again. And then Rosanoff's mouth picks up where it left off, and Shane stops talking. They both get their shirts off, yanking at each other's belts.
You will let me fuck you this time?
Rosanoff asks. He sticks his hand down Shane's pants to strengthen his case. Shane has to admit it's a pretty good argument. He tips his head back and squeezes his eyes shut.
Yeah. First time, yes? You think you can take my whole cock?
Shane has experimented on his own. He isn't going to say practiced, even though that's what it had been. Teaching himself how to relax and open up, learning how to take it. He'd gauged the size of the probe from the memory of Rosanoff's stick in his mouth. He's not telling Rosanoff any of that.
I think I know my body. I should get to know it better then.
Rosanoff's mouth opens over Shane's pack, teeth grazing his skin, before he pulls his hand out of Shane's pants and slaps the side of his ass.
Take all these off.
Shane rolls onto his knees, prompted by Rosanoff's hands on his hips. He hunches over, embarrassed by how exposed he feels in this position, thinking about the view Rosanoff must have. Rosanoff plants a hand between his shoulder blades and presses down, until Shane's elbows buckle and his cheek presses against the scratchy polyester pillows, his spine arched wanton and inviting. The back of his neck burns. The tip of a probe wraps against his rim. Shane clenches instinctively against it before he forces himself to relax.
Have you done this before?
Rosanoff teases him with the length of it, lubricant squeezing from the tip to trickle along his crease.
You know what comes next?
Shane buries his face in the pillows to muffle his words.
Just do it.
The probe Shane uses on himself is a tight, insertable spiral. It unfurls like a fiddle fern inside him, dripping slick sap as it opens and swells, expanding until the fullness becomes too much and Shane jerks off frantically, spilling over his fist. This one is a knobbly, flexible cylinder. Shane has to fight not to squirm as it slides in, deeper than he'd expected. Rosanoff taps the base, and Shane jolts forward slightly, startled by the sensation and the squirt of lubricant. The probe expands in slow increments, an increased pressure that never tips over into pain. Shane breathes through it, shuddering as its girth swells and stretches him open. By the time it starts to feel like too much, testing his resistance, Shane is panting open-mouthed and through the pile of pillows. Rozanov's big hands knead his ass, spreading his cheeks and squeezing.
Still good.
Shane must manage a coherent reply, because the probe expands one last time, wide enough to tear a groan from his throat, and then deflates. Shane clenches when it withdraws, already missing the fullness. Then Rozanov shifts behind him and eases forward into the empty space. The stretch is familiar, the way his body adjusts to accommodate an intrusion. But he isn't prepared for the additional sensory input. He hasn't experienced the friction of a thrust, the drag of Rozanov's cock inside him. He hasn't fallen into a rhythm with someone like this, felt the heat of another body against the backs of his thighs. He hasn't heard the slap of skin as they pick up the pace, or the grunts and gasps that filter through the blood roaring in his ears. Shane doesn't realize he's going to come until his rhythm breaks and he seizes up, riding the waves of an orgasm that seems endless. He's still floating on aftershocks when Rozanov swears, grips his hips tighter, and spurts inside him. They both pause to catch their breath, and gradually the rest of the world filters back in. Rozanov is careful when he pulls out, but the gaping emptiness is still an uncomfortable feeling. Rozanov cleans him up with soft fabric, swabbing gently over his dick and ass. Shane hopes it's a scarf Rozanov was wearing earlier, and not one of Shane's few clean shirts. He rolls himself over with effort, aching and boneless. Rozanov smirks down at him. The ground trembles. Rozanov tenses, hand dropping to his side for a weapon that isn't there.
Seismic activity, Shane tells him. This is one of the most unstable regions on the continent.
Rozanov relaxes again and reaches for his clothes.
Sounds like a bad place to stick around.
Even fucked out and unguarded, Shane isn't going to talk to Rozanov about an active mission. He watches the muscles flex as Rozanov pulls his shirt over his head. Shane hadn't gotten his hands into Rozanov's hair. It still pomaded into perfect curls. The sweat is already drying on his skin. When he slips out the door a few minutes later, there's no evidence he'd been with Shane at all.
Unstable ground, Shane thinks.
The smoke from the explosion has finally reached the trailer. Shane can taste it on the back of his tongue. There is nothing else lingering there to drive it away.
Jane, I found your rose. You could have warned me about the thorns, but it probably wouldn't have stopped me. I'm reckless when it comes to you. I've never had a memory embed itself in my skin. I didn't know what I was seeing until I heard your voice and recognized your hands. I hope you know how hard it was, watching and not being able to touch. I think I like it better when I can react, when you respond to me. I'm not complaining, though. Having your memory is better than not having any of you. It's still strange, watching it play out, knowing this is something that's already happened, and it can't be changed. Wanting to answer you when you talk to me, to replace your hands with mine, to see the way you flush when I whisper in your ear. Passively watching a timeline unfold isn't how I experience history. See you soon, Lily.
Chapter 4. Moi j'attends, toi tu pars. Ilya's sea spider dodges fishing trawlers and cruise ships as it scuttles out of the harbor. It's a marvel of 22nd century engineering, a multi-purpose marine vehicle lauded for its distinctive profile and modular design, if not its energy efficiency. Ilya likes it because it can go very, very fast. He's more comfortable in motion than he is standing still. He's not like Hollander, who has an architecture fetish and a preference for boring, structurally sound buildings on solid ground. Ilya fully expects Hollander to take one look at his mechanical arthropod and make a face like he's just sucked on a lemon. Ilya slows down once he clears the islands, coasting over the open ocean until he finally drifts to a stop. He switches vehicle modes, and the sea spider's body lowers to the water's surface.
Its long legs fold up and stretch overhead into a new configuration, a framework of triangles to stretch out the canvas sails Ilya deploys a moment later. The boat bobs lazily, peacefully adrift on the water. These coordinates are far enough out that boat traffic is barely visible on the horizon. No one is around for 100 kilometers. The sea spider rocks abruptly to one side, unbalanced by additional weight. Its hull squeaks in protest as someone scrabbles against it. Ilya leans over the side to rescue Hollander, who's made it halfway up but can't quite reach the rail. Ilya hauls him onto the deck, feeling very strong and masculine about it.
"Why the fuck do you have a mega yacht?" Hollander demands, and makes the lemon face.
"Because she's the most beautiful thing I have ever seen," Ilya tells him, and manages to bite his tongue before he adds anything stupid like, "except for you." It's not his fault for thinking it. Hollander in a wetsuit is everything Ilya had imagined it would be.
"When I got your message, I thought you'd made a mistake with the coordinates," Hollander says.
Ilya gives him an offended look. "I never make mistakes."
"You hit the message in a fucking fish," Hollander continues, like this aids his argument.
He scruffs seawater from his hair and asks, aggrieved,
"The harbor, really?"
"Century-long capital of bioengineering," Ilya defends himself. "Best place to make a fish. It reminded me of you." He'd wondered if Hollander would be brave enough to show up here. In this strand, in the century, Boston Harbor is at the heart of the Raiders' territory. They'll lose it to the Voyageurs eventually, ushering in the golden age of bioengineering that will one day lead to the scales glittering at Hollander's throat. For now, Hollander is behind enemy lines, trusting Ilya to keep him safe and undiscovered. To avoid examining any of the things Ilya feels about that, he steps close enough to see the pattern of individual scales that disappear beneath Hollander's collar.
"We should get you out of those wet clothes," Ilya suggests.
Hollander rolls his eyes, but he's just as eager to peel away the neoprene and launch himself naked into Ilya's embrace. He drops to his knees on the deck barely a minute later. Ilya's never met anyone so desperate to suck his dick. Hollander's mouth wraps around him in ways that shouldn't be possible. Ilya could swear his tongue forks like a snake's when Hollander swallows him, although he's never felt that when they kiss. Hollander would probably tell him about the biological advantages of chemical scenting or something that should be incredibly boring, which Ilya will inevitably find really fucking hot. Ilya pulls Hollander off and follows him down onto the deck. This part has become familiar with practice. The slide and stretch to ease the way for Ilya's dick, the sounds Hollander makes when he gets impatient, his heels digging into Ilya's ass. Hollander is intensely physical, in a way Ilya hasn't experienced with any other lover, responsive and hungry for Ilya's body against his. He gets under Ilya's skin, raking gouges down Ilya's back and leaving behind the imprints of his teeth. They've left bruises on each other, dark smudges of color that ripen in the days after the last encounter. Their timelines don't match up exactly. Ilya makes a game of guessing how long it's been for Hollander by the pattern and shade of Ilya's marks on his skin. Every time Hollander breaks his skin, Ilya thinks about contact poison, assassination. That's part of the thrill of it. He's always liked a little danger. After they finish, Ilya lets himself look. If he's honest with himself, this is what he'd wanted when he'd sent these coordinates. Hollander's skin, golden in the sun, freckles darkening and spreading across his broad shoulders. His chest and stomach damp with sweat and pearled with semen. His brown eyes, slitted against the bright glare as he looks back at Ilya, languid and content. Canvas snaps above them as wind catches in the sails. Ilya says, without really meaning to,
"You should go sailing with me."
Hollander's lips twitch through several attempts at hiding a smile.
"Can you even sail this thing?"
"What is there to know? You point it in the right direction and the boat goes." Hollander shakes his head. "That's not how it works, asshole." Ilya rolls on top of him and bites his collarbone.
"Maybe you should show me."
Hollander sighs. He buries his hands in Ilya's hair to cradle his head. We shouldn't risk it. We got lucky with Sochi.
Ilya stops moving with his mouth still open over Hollander's nipple. He pulls back slowly, licking saliva from his lips.
What about Sochi?
Hollander frowns at him.
Your message about quarantine along the Black Sea, warning about the black mold, the one Hunter passed along.
Ilya's voice is tight, betraying too much of his agitation.
Why would I tell you about mold? You think I would give away secrets from our side?
I thought you wanted to make sure I was safe. Hollander gets his elbows under him and pushes up. Ilya sits back on his heels to give him room. This no longer feels like a conversation they can have while horizontal.
I still want to win the war, Hollander.
These little interludes with Hollander haven't changed that. If anything, they've made Ilya more competitive, inclined to take greater risks and show off his skill.
Don't worry. When we win, I will keep you as my very sexy prisoner.
Hollander doesn't seem to register the joke.
You're the only one in contact with Hunter. No one on my side knows anything about him. Why would he warn me if it didn't come from you?
Ilya shrugs and deflects. Internally, he panics about how much he doesn't know and how far the situation has spiraled out of his control.
I'm not in contact. He shadows me. I only see him sometimes. He must shadow you too.
Hollander goes pale.
If he's following both of us, do you think he knows?
Ilya thinks it's very fucking likely. Aloud he says,
What is there to know? We fuck around. It's nothing.
He's rubbing his nose, giving himself away. He has too many fucking tells. Thankfully, Hollander is in full crisis mode and oblivious to anything else.
I shouldn't be here, he mutters.
He squirms free and stands before Ilya can stop him.
I have to go. Sweetheart,
Ilya says, without permission from his brain to his mouth. It sounds too much like what he wants to say and can't.
Wait. Stay.
Hollander doesn't even stop to pull on his wetsuit. Before Ilya can try to stop him, he dives off the side of the yacht and splashes into the cold Atlantic. Ilya stares at the water until the waves erase all signs of a disturbance. He only has himself to blame. He'd sent Hollander a bioengineered fish like some stupid Valentine, and lured him out here to see scales flash on Hollander's skin in the sunlight. Now Hollander is swimming downside as fast as he can to get away.
Lily, I didn't mean to call you a traitor. That's not what I meant. I know you wouldn't betray your side. Sometimes I think I might, if it was for you, and that scares me more than anything. I don't think we should do this anymore. I don't think it's good for us. Stay safe out there. Jane.
Promenade à deux, in its heyday at the start of the 22nd century, is one of the cultural icons of space tourism. Built after the age of suborbital rockets and corporate space planes, the club broke away from popular futuristic aesthetics to embrace the glitzy comfort of a North American tourist trap. The interior is lit almost entirely by black light, to avoid competing with the view of the stars outside. The club is universally known by its unofficial name, taken from the enormous neon letters that line a bank of windows. Glow. Shane hates pretty much everything about it. The lurid uranium glass decor gives him a headache. His throat hurts from having to raise his voice over the thumping music and crowd noise. There are people everywhere, pressed up against each other like tin sardines. It's too hot and humid for his drink to stay cold longer than a few minutes. There are scorpions crawling around inside the cocktail tables, and those things give Shane the heebie-jeebies. He replayed what happened outside Boston Harbor on a loop during his mission briefing, until management noticed and asked why he was so distracted. Management is too focused on Shane already, on what he can do as the Voyageurs' vanguard. He doesn't need to give them any reason to look inside his head. Then he showed up here, and found the place already full of raiders. Landry appears at his elbow, holding a glow-in-the-dark cocktail that can't be healthy to drink. Shane can practically feel his DNA taking damage just looking at it.
The good news is, there are too many of us here for them to start something, Landry reports, pausing to take a sip of a drink. The bad news is that there are an awful lot of them, too.
Yeah.
Shane tells himself not to look. He'll only draw attention to himself, scanning the club for one face in the crowd. The lighting in here makes it impossible anyway. He glances once over the dance floor, at the sea of neon body paint and chemiluminescence. Maintaining some surveillance is just a smart move. Landry groans and finishes off her cocktail. We're not getting anywhere tonight. Want to dance?
Do I look like I want to dance?
Landry laughs. I forget how funny you are. Dance with me anyway? Her dress is made from narrow strips of rolled fabric. It reflects the club's UV light like a silver screen, shimmering between hot pink and electric blue when she takes Shane's hand and leads him toward the dance floor.
Look at it this way. We're farther away from the scorpions, she yells encouragingly.
Shane will give her that much. He puts his hands awkwardly at her waist and tries to bob along to the baseline. There's not really anywhere safe for him to touch her in that dress. Landry grins like she knows what he's thinking.
You could have made some effort to blend in.
I'm wearing a white shirt, Shane protests.
Oh, Shane, never change.
Landry loops her arms around his neck and rests her head on his shoulder. It's an angle that means she's taking advantage of the sightline to check the balcony for raiders. She adjusts to speak near his ear so he can hear her over the music.
Do you know these guys?
Shane scans the dance floor again. Some of them. He doesn't know whether the raiders got wind of their plan, or the voyageur intercepted them in the middle of their own, or if they all just saw a good move on the chessboard and tried to make it at the same time. He supposes it doesn't matter. Then Shane sees Rosanoff across the room, and the rest of the club goes muffled, like a blanket has been thrown over all the light and noise. Shane didn't realize he'd started looking for him again. Maybe he never really stopped. Rosanoff's shirt is nearly transparent, open down the front to reveal his chest. Shane thinks he's wearing body paint at first. Then he sees the way the design shifts, prowling across his abs and up his torso. It's an ultraviolet tattoo, inked in bright fluorescence. A leopard one moment, spotted yellow and green, then a roaring orange bear. A series of predators on the hunt. Rosanoff catches his eye and raises a glass in toast. His other arm is wrapped around a woman painted from head to toe. His hand is out of sight, pushed under the crop top that covers her breasts. Rosanoff dips his head, never breaking eye contact with Shane. The tip of his tongue traces a line up her long neck. The club noise comes rushing back in. Shane jerks his head away, feeling sick. He doesn't want to be here.
Hey!
Landry tilts his face back towards her. Shane can't meet her eyes, so he looks down and squeezes her waist in acknowledgement. Landry purses her lips in concern.
Do you need to go?
Shane shakes his head.
We're soldiers. I go where I'm needed.
We're people, too, Landry reminds him gently. You're not looking great.
I'm fine.
It's a lie, and they both know it. Shane steps back and lets his hands fall to his sides.
I'm just going to...
Landry nods, letting him go. Shane pushes uncomfortably through the dancers toward the washrooms. He needs to get away from the music and splash cold water on his face. He needs a minute to collect himself. He needs to know if Rosanoff will see him leave and follow him back here. He's stupid for even thinking about it. They're both here on a mission, surrounded by other agents. There's nothing they could say to each other, even if they did end up in the same narrow hallway, the same cramped stall.
There's a mural painted on the wall outside the washrooms. Shane stares at the gleaming purple scorpion and wonders if Rosanoff will leave a message for him here.
The scorpion's stinger reminds him of the rose he crafted, his hand-picked memory embedded into one sharp thorn. He remembers the giant Atlantic bluefin tuna that scared the shit out of Shane when it surfaced beside him, several hundred years and dozens of strands ago, which Rosanoff sent because he wanted to make a dumb joke about Shane being part fish. Shane finds what he's looking for inside the washroom stall. Graffiti scrawled in careless, thick marker.
Jane, probably you are right. Talking is a bad idea. War is more important. Sending messages means we might not pretend to hate each other so well. If this is what you want, then good luck with Voyageurs. You will need it. We will not go easy on you. We can go our separate ways from here. No one will ever need to know. For a good time, don't call. Lily.
Chapter 5. Your rails have always outrun mine. The last person Ilya expects to see along a parade route is Hollander. Ilya almost passes by without seeing him, except that Hollander stands out from the crowd, except that Ilya looks for him everywhere without meaning to, so at first he thinks it's his mind playing tricks. Ilya breaks away from the locals he's fallen in with and weaves his way to Hollander's side. He catches the sleeve of Hollander's coat and steers him off the main road.
Hollander, why are you here?
Hollander pulls his sleeve out of Ilya's grasp and tucks his coat down. Same as you, probably. Ilya highly doubts that. His visit here isn't exactly officially sanctioned. The last time he saw Hollander, he was snuck in the bosom of one of his fellow voyageurs, leading an entire strike team to counter the raiders' advance.
This is Tren 1217. No one comes here. It's too...
Ilya can't think of the word in English. He makes a hand gesture instead, indicating the timeline diverting dramatically off course.
You're here?
There's the slightest hint of a pout around Hollander's mouth. That expression shouldn't be allowed on his face. His lower lip doesn't need any more emphasis. It makes it hard for Ilya not to think about kissing him.
So what? The Voyageurs sent you to stop me from carrying out this very important mission?
Ilya raises his eyebrows. Hollander's sulky mouth pinches into a scowl. Now that Ilya's made the mistake of looking at him, he can't look anywhere else. He's going to miss the whole fucking parade because of Hollander's lips.
I'm here for the invasion, Hollander says.
His cheeks are pink, freckles darkening with his flushed skin. Ilya's situation is becoming more perilous by the moment. He can't blame everything on his distraction and the number of drinks he's had already. He's fairly certain Hollander isn't making any sense.
Your side is attacking. Here.
He points down at the street beneath them, littered with strings of plastic beads and crumpled napkins. It's hardly a high-profile target. Hollander is definitely blushing now. It hasn't lessened the impact of his adorable scowl.
The pirate invasion, asshole.
Ilya stares at him, really seeing Hollander for the first time. He's wearing a woolen fear-not coat and wide cropped trousers, all in drab shades of blue-gray. There's a long knife and a leather scabbard tucked into his belt that will get him arrested if anyone realizes it's not a fake.
Hollander.
Ilya gestures around them at the costumes in the crowd. It's all feathered hats and overflowing corsets, long scarlet coats with shiny gold buttons.
It's not a real invasion. This is a party. They sail one ship into the harbor, set off fake cannons. Boom.
Hollander's gaze skitters down the parade route and back to him. Ilya tries not to notice that it lingers on the open front of Ilya's poet shirt, on the strip of bare chest framed by white lace ruffles.
So why are you here?
Ilya throws his hands up.
To get drunk. To get laid. To wear stupid clothes and have people throw beads because I'm hot. This strand doesn't matter. You really came here to foil this terrible enemy plot.
Hollander looks away, avoiding Ilya's face, before he seems to force himself to make eye contact.
No. I want to talk.
This, Ilya thinks, is far worse than the Voyageurs staging an invasion. The potential devastation is too high to calculate.
There's nothing to talk about.
It's not even a good deflection, just a reflexive attempt to stop whatever might come out of Hollander's mouth. He should have remembered how single-minded Hollander can be when he wants something.
You said you're not on a mission, right? So there's probably no one watching. We can talk here. About us.
And then what? It's the future Ilya hasn't let himself think about. The one in which his life is more than an endless string of military actions and stolen moments with Hollander for a quick fuck.
We meet up another time, and again after that, until someone catches us, and we get killed by our own sides.
What? No.
Hollander looks horrified.
That's not... They'd really kill you?
He's so naive. Ilya feels disgusted with himself for wanting to preserve that innocence, when he knows the rest of the universe will only take advantage of it.
You think they wouldn't kill you? Why? Because you're their prize vanguard?
No, they'd erase you.
There's new tension in Hollander's voice, and the way he's holding himself.
My memories are saved to a synaptic storage drive. If they found out about us, they wouldn't risk it getting out. They'd wipe my memory as far back as our first meeting. It would be like it never happened.
Ilya stares at him. He should sit down before his unsteady legs betray him. He thinks he might be sick. At least he wouldn't be the first person vomiting into the gutter today. Hollander starts fidgeting when he doesn't respond.
You just said the raiders would kill you. It's not worse than that.
It is. It's so much worse. For reasons Ilya can't even put into words. They've been in each other's lives for years, braiding and untangling each other's threads. There's no way to erase Ilya without taking a decade of Hollander's life along with him. Who Hollander is now, as a person, has been shaped in part by his time with Ilya. Pieces of him would be lost that couldn't be rebuilt.
I guess I should have told you before this.
Hollander keeps talking like this is a practical matter.
If we ever meet somewhere and I don't seem to know you, it might be that we are at a new intersection of the timeline and I haven't really met you yet, but it could also be that.
Ilya sits down abruptly on the curb. Hollander hovers for a few seconds, staring at the filthy sidewalk, before he sits beside Ilya. Ilya keenly feels the chasm between them, this lack of shared understanding that rears its head at the strangest times. It seems impossible to reach past it, like they're groping for each other in the dark, from opposite sides of an ocean. Hollander is trying to build a bridge.
The Colonel, who gives me orders,
Ilya says eventually. He looks at his knees, because it isn't safe to say this aloud, but it especially isn't safe to say it while looking at Hollander.
He doesn't always remember when he is, or what's happened. He forgets things. He's losing time. I can't trust the missions anymore. He might not remember sending me. I might not come back.
Hollander draws in a breath. Ilya rubs his earlobe between his fingers and waits for him to say what they're both thinking. Continuity lapse. A weakness that could turn the tide of the war. Or a vulnerability that might extend to both sides, if Hollander's people are erasing their own memories to control what everyone thinks. Instead, Hollander says,
I would remember. I'd find you.
Ilya thinks, if they take me away from you, there will be no one left to mourn me. Hollander reaches out to put a hand on his knee. Ilya threads their fingers together and holds on.
Lily, I never told you why I started sending you my memories. You can probably guess now. If anything happens to me, I'd like to think there's some part of me out there that will survive if my other memories are erased. I want that part to stay with the person who knows me best. I trust you. More than I should, probably, but you've never let me down. I know that my memories, every emotion I experience in those moments, my private thoughts, they're all safe with you. I save all of your messages. Not just the words themselves, but the memory of reading them. The way I feel when I find each one. The things I think about you. They can't erase us completely. Not anymore. Jane.
Rozanov licks a stripe up Shane's neck, bites at his earlobe, and murmurs,
I think I will make you scream for me.
Oh, fuck you, Shane hisses through his teeth. It's not his best comeback, but Rozanov has fucked most of the coherence out of him.
Other way around, I think.
Rozanov grinds in slow and deep, and Shane bites his tongue to stop himself from whimpering. Rozanov put him on his back, so there's nothing to muffle the noises he's making. Rozanov pulls back and snaps his hips forward without warning, and Shane's hand flies up to grip the pillow. His jaw clenches so hard it aches.
Should have put you on top and made you ride me.
Rozanov somehow manages conversational shit talk even while he's out of breath from how hard he's fucking Shane into the mattress.
I like these too, though, when I make you lie there and take it.
Stop talking, Shane whispers furiously, which is a mistake. It means his mouth is already open and his lungs are pushing out air when Rozanov hits him just the right way. He moans, too loud, and the vibrating ring around his dick buzzes and tightens enough to make him gasp.
Do you want to play a game? Rozanov asked once they'd been naked in bed together.
Shane heard the other question. Will you trust me? As clearly as if Rozanov said it aloud. He thought Rozanov wanted to try something a little different, like a 69, or to fuck in some new position. Instead, he got a vibrating cock ring. There's a sensor stuck to the hollow of Shane's throat, programmed to a specific number of decibels. Shane can whisper, he can moan if it's breathy enough, but anything more than that sets it off. It gets more intense the louder he is. Rozanov's voice doesn't set it off, which is good, because he won't shut the fuck up.
I thought you were going to be quiet, Rozanov jokes.
He leans down to graze his teeth beside Shane's armpit, pushing Shane's knees back towards his shoulders until his thighs ache from the stretch. They started this with Shane's legs around Rozanov's waist, but after Shane set the fucking ring off and kicked Rozanov for the third time, Rozanov decided instead to pin him down and fold him in half.
Shut up, Shane whispers, and pretends he isn't begging.
Rozanov's teeth find his nipple, and Shane breaks again, his voice rising in a series of punched-out groans that only get louder as the vibrations crank up in response. He wants to come, and the only way to do that is to stay quiet. He bites the inside of his cheek and stifles the whimpers rising in his throat, squeezing his eyes shut so he doesn't have to see Rozanov, sweaty and red-faced and glorious above him, watching his own dick move in and out of Shane's ass. Shane could also tap out. Rozanov had been very clear about that, about stopping this at any time. They might have both underestimated how competitive Shane could get in bed. Shane is close. He's so fucking close. Rozanov adjusts his grip on Shane's leg so he can crush Shane against the mattress and suck a bruise onto Shane's throat. His mouth closes over the sensor when he hums, loud and deliberate, and the ring tightens around Shane's dick fast enough to stop his orgasm right as he's teetering on the edge.
You fucking bastard! Fuck you! Fuck! Shane gasps, lightheaded.
His dick hasn't figured out yet that it can't get off, his hips jerking up desperately in search of stimulation.
Sorry, did you want to come?
Rozanov asks, and Shane is gratified to at least hear some strain in his voice now. Both of them are getting increasingly desperate, but still unwilling to give in first. Rozanov kisses his neck and presses forward into another slow, filthy grind. Shane's eyes flutter shut, and his nails dig into Rozanov's back, holding him close.
Ilya!
He breathes, too loud, his voice breaking on the word. It takes a few seconds for him to realize he hasn't set off the sensor.
Programmable,
Ilya had explained when he'd squeezed Shane's cock in his hand and slipped the ring over his balls. Shane had thought he'd meant the decibel level, not...
Ilya,
he says again, testing. He feels Rozanov tense, thrusting forward hard enough to punch Shane's breath out of him. He wonders if Rozanov knew he'd be this affected, or if they've both been taken by surprise. Rozanov braces himself in Shane's legs and starts fucking him again. Faster, the build-up to the finish. their gazes lock, neither of them flinching. Shane has a cheat code now, and he's going to use it. He loves to win. He pulls Rozanov down into a messy, wet kiss, mostly teeth and tongue, and drags in a deep breath.
Ilya! Ilya! Ilya!
He chants, and rides the blissful wave into orgasm. They kiss for a long time afterward, lingering more than they should, reluctant to shed the softer skins they wear for each other and don their armor again. Rozanov brushes his knuckles over Shane's cheek, and the chromatophores under Shane's skin rearrange themselves, responding to his touch.
We'll see each other soon.
Shane says it almost as a reassurance for himself. Strand 1919, right?
Yes,
Rozanov agrees. He holds Shane's jaw in his hand and tilts Shane's chin up to kiss the corner of his mouth.
I will see you there.
And we'll write, Shane says. Will you let me know if... I don't want you to tell me any military secrets, but when you report in, if your orders... If anything... He trails off, aware that he's asking for the impossible. Aware, too, that the man in his arms will try to give it to him if Shane asks. He finishes softly, I just want to know that you're okay.
I know.
Rozanov kisses him again, brief and disarmingly tender.
You vary too much.
Shane rests his hand over Rozanov's heart. He leaves another shard of memory like a splinter under Rozanov's skin before he goes. Another piece of himself broken off and given away. He might leave his heart behind with it.
My Jane, I don't know what to tell you about my missions. I don't want you to worry. The truth is, I don't know what to say about the war at all. I have new assignments that might as well be the same ones I've carried out already, time and time again, in strand after strand. It's always felt pointless, undoing your work just so you could undo mine. It's been even worse lately. I don't know if I am doing any of it. I don't want to be working against you. The only thing I want is to be with you. The only thing that feels real in all of this is hearing your voice, seeing your face. Nothing else matters. Especially not a war that started before you and I were born, and will carry on after we're gone. The only battles I want to fight are by your side. I am yours first, and everyone else's after. Your Lily.
Chapter 6. Tout près de la place où tes pieds passent.
Early summer in the city is sticky and humid, and the daily afternoon rain showers don't do anything to break the heat. The stench of warm garbage rotting in the street isn't as bad on the viaduct as it is further up the island, but the smell of the nearby river is only marginally better. Ilya walks along an abandoned freight line, high above the street traffic. Patches of grass poke up between the rails, nature reclaiming what it can of this concrete metropolis. He's here to make noise the way he does best, to provoke the voyageurs into overextending their resources. If he can annoy them enough to chase after him, he can tie up a half dozen of their agents combing this timeline, trying to figure out what he's doing here and why. Ilya's doing fuck all, besides walking down a railway and listening to the ever-present soundtrack of car horns and sirens. It's not the best use of his skills, but Marlowe had been right when he'd said that where Ilya led, the boatman would follow. Don't stick around too long, Marlowe had warned. If you spot trouble, get out of there. Hollander probably isn't the sort of trouble Marlowe meant, but it's his silhouette against the skyline up ahead, so familiar that Ilya's heart speeds up before his brain fully registers why. Shane cocks his head at Ilya, quizzical. This isn't where they'd agreed to meet up. He must be wondering what Ilya's doing out here. Ilya's wristband pings with a message from Marlowe. He's not the only one to notice Shane's presence then. Ilya expects an alert about temporal activity, so it takes a moment to understand what he's seeing. It's an evacuation warning. A countdown. Ilya looks up. Shane's keeping his distance,
still confused by this deviation from Ilya's original mission, or perhaps worried. He promised that he wouldn't let Ilya be lost and forgotten. Shane looks vulnerable, standing alone on the viaduct, a stationary target. Ilya's mouth goes dry. He thought he was here playing decoy. He hadn't realized he was bait for a trap. Ilya can't feel the electromagnetic pulse detonate. Power blacks out across the grid, and he hears car horns and shouting from the streets below. He's aware of his wristband and lenses shorting out, all of the technology he carries suddenly reduced to scrap metal. It's an inconvenience, but his body isn't physically affected by it. Shane is different. Shane has embedded microchips and a synaptic storage drive linked to his brain. He has nanobots swimming around in all his vital organs. Shane goes down like someone flipped a switch and turned him off. For a handful of seconds, Ilya stands frozen, watching Shane's body twitch and spasm into stillness, sprawled across the train tracks. Then he runs. By the time Ilya reaches him, Shane's skin has turned gray. His freckles are flakes of ash. Ilya remembers how he'd looked walking down Bay Street in Toronto, half a lifetime ago, his nose wrinkled at the smoke. Shane! Ilya drops to his knees on the rotting railway ties. Shane still hasn't moved. Ilya grips his shoulders and shakes him, because he doesn't know what else to do. None of the other voyageurs are here. Or if they are, they aren't coming to help. The EMP would have taken out anyone close by. Shane's head lolls to the side. Ilya cups his cheek and tries not to panic.
You have to tell me what to do, he says. Shane, wake up. What am I supposed to do?
Shane's eyelids flutter.
Emergency beacon,
he slurs, so garbled that Ilya struggles to understand him.
Activate.
Ilya's hands fumble and shake as Shane talks him through it, barely conscious. Ilya tells him sharply to stay awake, his throat closing around the words.
You can't be here. They can't see you,
Shane mumbles.
I am not leaving you, Hollander.
Ilya isn't sure the emergency beacon still works, or that the voyageur will be able to pinpoint this location in the blackout. Shane's hand lands clumsily on Ilya's chest.
Ilya.
Ilya isn't going anywhere, not while Shane is alone and losing consciousness, not without knowing whether or not help will arrive in time. He knows why Shane is afraid. If the voyageurs find them like this, they'll ask questions. They'll look into Shane's memories. They'll cut Ilya out of him like a cancer, leaving nothing behind. Ilya can't stay. He forces himself to stand and walk away. Slow and wooden at first, and then faster, because everything in him is screaming to turn around and go back. He clatters down the stairs from the viaduct to street level and heads north into the village. Then he goes up Thread. Not far. A handful of years, barely a blip on the timeline. Ilya scouted the strand before the mission. He knows who else is close by, shadowing his footsteps and watching his every move. It's time the hunter became the hunted. The Stonewall restaurant's windows are blacked out and boarded up. Ilya's fist thuds against one of the steel plates reinforcing the front doors, and a peephole opens up. He knows all the right things to say to gain admittance to a private club like this one. How to flirt his way in, to show he's someone who obviously belongs here. He can't think of any of them. His thoughts are an endless, dizzy loop of Shane falling to the ground and not getting back up.
Let me in, he snarls at last, pushed beyond patience.
He isn't particularly surprised when the peephole snaps shut in his face. He is surprised at the grinding sound of bolts sliding back, and the door cracking open a few seconds later. It's dark inside, the walls painted black and the lights intentionally dim. Ilya stumbles through the door and looks around. His gaze lands on a tall man with a short beard and broad shoulders, one whose eyes widen in recognition. Ilya would swear they've never met before.
Hunter, Ilya says.
It's only half a question. He's almost sure he's right.
Oh, shit, the tall man says. This is it, then.
You are Hunter, Ilya repeats.
He needs the confirmation.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you call me. I guess I'm used to it by now.
Ilya's blank incomprehension must be obvious, because Hunter explains,
You and I go way back. For me, anyway. I'm guessing that for you, this is the start.
How far back? Ilya demands. You were in Nashville, Vegas, Boston. You knew about Sochi.
Yeah, like I said, we go back.
Hunter approaches slowly, closing some of the distance between them. I knew you'd show up here eventually. There's a story here, an important one that Ilya probably needs to understand. Right now, he doesn't care.
Shane Hollander, he was hit by the electromagnetic pulse down thread. My people won't know what happened to him. I don't have any way to ask the voyageurs. You're the only one who can find out.
Ilya needs to know. He'll strike any bargain Hunter asks for, if it means Hunter will tell him whether Shane's still alive. He doesn't have any other way of getting information. Hunter has expressive eyes. Ilya sees understanding dawn in them, before Hunter grimaces and looks away.
You know, Ilya presses him. You know what happens to him.
Hunter reaches out as if to squeeze his shoulder, then seems to think better of it.
Holland is going to be fine. I can tell you that much.
Ilya clenches his hands into fists to stop himself from shoving Hunter against the wall.
How do you know?
Hunter hesitates, but he either decides it's best to share what he knows, or recognizes the impending violence in Ilya's eyes. I know because your boyfriend gets to me first, before you and I ever meet. At Ilya's stunned expression, Hunter rubs his hand over his mouth.
Oh, shit. Are you two not?
Ilya's off balance enough to answer with bald honesty.
Not yet, he admits. But I think we are close.
Right. Well, from what I know, he put some things together, and the two of you come up with a plan. I don't know the details. If anyone knew how Hollander's brain worked, they might have a chance in hell of keeping up with him.
The way Hunter says it implies familiarity beyond a one-time acquaintance. Ilya wonders exactly how long Hunter has known Shane.
All I can tell you is this. I made a decision that was important for me. I did it for myself. But I'm glad the two of you could benefit from it.
Defection, Ilya thinks. Leaving the war. He and Shane haven't spoken of it openly. Ilya's not sure they've even admitted the possibility to themselves. He thinks back through timelines, threats, scenarios. Their last conversation. He would know if Shane had made contact with Hunter. He's sure of it.
Shane hasn't met you yet.
Hunter raises his eyebrows and looks up, visibly grappling with how much to say.
Time travel, he says eventually.
He tilts his head toward the bar, leads Ilya to the counter, and flips over a pair of shot glasses.
This is where it gets messy.
Lily, I'm fine.
Management is keeping an eye on me for a while, but it won't last forever.
I'm sorry this happened. I should have been more careful.
Can you believe that when I saw you, I almost forgot about the war? There's something I wanted to ask you, although I didn't imagine it like this. There's somewhere I'd like you to see. It used to be the only place I felt like I could really be myself. You make me feel that way now, too. I've encrypted the coordinates, time and place. I hope you'll be there.
Jane.
Shane feels it when Ilya arrives. The air changes subtly, a held breath before a side exhale through the ventilation system. The white noise modulates from a background hum into the lap of lake water against the pebbled shore, and the whisper of a faint breeze through leaves. It's never truly silent here. Shane's thoughts are too loud and overwhelming for complete quiet. The sound doesn't always take a specific shape, though, one so vivid that Shane can picture the landscape in his mind. The grassy, vegetal scent of green tea fades. The briny trace of seaweed lingers longest on Shane's tongue. In its place is pine sap and wood smoke, clinging to Shane's nostrils when he inhales. Ilya comes into view, staring at the walls glowing softly with amber light. He catches sight of Shane and gestures at the organic structure around them.
What is this?
Shane looks up at the reassuring geometric pattern imprinted on the arched ceiling.
It's my, egg?
Ilya blinks at him.
You hatched like a bird.
No. Shane looks away, embarrassed and warm.
I mean, kind of. I came out of an incubation tank like everyone else, but no, this is...
home. His private sanctuary. His safe space. The truest expression of himself.
It's more like a manifestation of my subconscious. Kind of like a dream. It's a malleable construction. I can shape it however I want.
Malleable means weird bumps on the floor,
Ilya guesses, prodding at the spongy cushions with his toes.
It means...
Shane abandons the thought when Ilya crosses the distance and kisses him. It's sharp, desperate. Ilya wraps him up in both arms like he's afraid Shane will vanish if he lets go. He swallows the sound Shane makes, the surprise and relief and hunger, crushing Shane against his chest. The ambient noise shifts again to something low and soothing, a vibrating purr that tickles the soles of Shane's feet.
Hey, Shane murmurs. It's okay.
Ilya's head drops onto Shane's shoulder, hiding his expression. Shane threads his fingers through Ilya's hair and cradles the back of his head, giving him all the time he needs.
Fuck this war.
Ilya rubs his face against Shane's neck, voice thick. Shane tries to draw back to look at him, but Ilya holds onto him tighter. He sniffles once.
It's safe here.
Shane relaxes slowly, unwinding into the embrace.
Yeah, sealed with a molecular lock. It won't recognize anyone else's DNA.
Ilya lifts his head and wrinkles his nose.
It recognized mine.
Well, yeah.
Shane's face warms. When Ilya doesn't say anything more, obviously waiting for a reply, Shane lets out a huff of breath.
Are you trying to embarrass me, or do you really not know?
Ilya raises his eyebrows pointedly. Shane rolls his eyes and looks away, flushed.
You've left plenty of genetic material in me, asshole. This place definitely recognizes you.
Ilya's expression turns smug and pleased, and Shane shoves at his shoulder without any intention of actually letting him go. Ilya says,
So you made a spare key?
Yeah, I guess so.
Shane's hands settle on Ilya's shoulders, his arms folded between their chests. The raiders don't have controlled environments like this.
No. And no incubation tanks. They look for talented children. They take us to train in special schools. If we show aptitude, we become agents. They look everywhere, across time. Only the best students become raiders.
Shane's mouth falls open a little. He's heard rumors, but he's not sure he believed them. The experience Ilya describes is wildly different from his own. Shane was born into the war. His genetic donors are a seasoned time agent and a high-ranking official in the Voyageurs' command structure. Management is one of the first faces he remembers, smiling at him with pride as she taught him how to braid temporal threads. He imagines a small, frightened Ilya, plucked out of obscurity and taken away from the only home and family he knew. A shining talent too outstanding to ignore, one which landed him in the middle of a never-ending war. Shane wonders if there are others like them, learning these things about each other, fraternizing with the enemy. He wonders if Ilya's had the same thought, and if he hopes the two of them might not be alone.
We don't have to stay on opposite sides. It's a dangerous thought. There's nowhere else for them to go. Nowhere safe that they won't be hunted down. No one defects from the Voyageurs. Or, if they have, no one has been allowed to remember it. Except, Shane realizes slowly, that might not quite be true. Out loud, he says, "Where did Hunter defect from?" Ilya goes very still. His arms tighten around Shane, squeezing around his ribcage. Shane's mind has started whirring, piecing together fragments of long-ago conversation. "You said you thought he defected from your side, but I looked. There's no record of him joining the Voyageurs. If he left the Voyageurs, they might have deleted the evidence, but then you and the Raiders would know about him. Time agents don't appear out of nowhere. Who did he train with, and where did he go?" Shane remembers the fiber optic cable Ilya left for him, strands of glass peeled apart to reveal a message and pulses of light. "You said he was called Hunter," Shane remembers. "How did you know?" Ilya is rigid against him. He's silent for a long moment before he speaks. "I didn't lie." Shane shakes his head. "No, that's not what I meant. Why did he warn me about Sochi? I knew exactly when to arrive to graft a message for you onto that orange tree. We couldn't plant computer viruses in Nashville because he got there before either of us. Right before us. Before anyone else could notice the disruption to the alarms and cameras. How does he know so much?" Shane meets Ilya's eyes and sees Ilya searching his face with a kind of wild hope. "He's hiding from both sides," Shane says, testing the words to hear whether they ring true. "He's created blind spots to cover his tracks, and he's done it so well that no one even knows to look for him. He's erased himself." Shane swallows. Just because he wants it to be true doesn't mean it is. "If he's erased himself so completely that we're the only ones who know about him, then he could do it for us too. He can teach us how to get away, how to hide. Somewhere we can be together." Ilya's throat works before he speaks. "This is what you want? You would leave the war?" It's a question with a complicated answer. It means abandoning everyone else Shane knows, giving up on a cause he used to believe in. Getting to know Ilya has changed his perspective, however, shifted his black-and-white view of their conflict. He can't forget everything and put the blinders back on. He can be honest with himself. And with Ilya. "I would," Shane tells him, "if it meant I could be with you." Ilya crushes Shane against his chest, muffling Russian words into the side of Shane's neck and meshing kisses along his jaw. He presses their foreheads together and holds Shane's face in his hands, like he's something wondrous and precious. "I'm going to find Hunter," Shane promises. He closes his eyes and leans into the pressure of Ilya's steady hands. "We'll figure out a way." "I know," Ilya says. He's sniffling again, throat tight. Ilya reaches into his jacket pocket and pulls out an unmarked shot glass. It's been used, sticky liquor residue dried up at the bottom and grease smeared along the rim from someone's lips. Ilya holds it out on the palm of his hand. Shane's gaze flicks from the glass to Ilya, questioning. "Another spare key, so you can find him." Ilya's eyes crinkle at the corners, his expression going soft. "Hunter says you'll know what to do." "Jane, I can tell you this now. You were right about Hunter. He told me that I created the seed, but you would know how to make it bloom. You told him how to find us in every strand. Everywhere our feet passed, every place we lingered together. He's already been there, striking us from the official record, smudging out any sign we were there. There's no trace of us left in those places, only in our memories. I think he's glad not to be the only one. No one wants to be alone. I'm grateful every day that I found you. Я тебя люблю, Лили." The end.